All right. We have a lot of content to go through, so I'm going to get started on time. My name is Ankur Kothari. I'm from the U.S. I've been doing some of our compliance workloads for the last 4 years, everything across Exchange, SharePoint, and Link. Exchange I've been doing for about 10 years. And I'm a product manager in charge of all of the compliance workspace. So I spent a lot of my time thinking about this technology, speaking to lawyers, speaking to compliance officers, having some of the very, very uncomfortable decisions and uncomfortable discussions, but just trying to get people aware of what we're doing and making that awareness lead to, you know, better usage of the technology that you already have, as well as better usage of the products that you're thinking about evaluating. I've been with Microsoft for 11 years. I've done a number of different things, but I'm excited to be here speaking to you about compliance. I'm also going to take a little bit of a slightly different tact. I'm going to present off of a tablet. I like to. I have a little bit of the lecturer in me, if you will, and I like to circle things as we go. So please disregard it if it's bothering you. Just raise your hand and I'll stop. But like I said, we have a ton of content. I want to walk you through. I want to do a few demos. If you have questions, this is a small group. Just feel free to raise your hand, blurt it out, and we'll address it there. The time is yours. I want to make sure it's useful to you. A little bit of a backdrop on what we're doing from a compliance space. So we've spent about 10,000 hours talking to compliance people, lawyers, IT professionals, IT decision makers on what does it mean? What does it mean when we talk about compliance? What do you actually need? What are you looking at? In that same time frame, we talked to these customers. We actually looked at what was out there in the industry, and we found that there were some gaps both on what was out there and what customers actually wanted. And the first and foremost was when we looked at those products that were out there, they customer's end-user experience was pretty terrible. Whether it was a product like Symantec's Enterprise Vault, and they're using different technologies to read the email, or if you want to search it, you have to use a different interface, or if you want to access it, you have to use a completely different way of looking at that content. Or even from the admin side, you have to think about multiple versions of high availability, how you're going to manage that, what's your SLA around this content. And having a basically two-headed approach was something that was causing a ton of different problems for organizations. And so when we set about designing our compliance story around all of our Office 2013 product sets, so we kind of had that as one of our major tenets to say, let's make sure we have the top-end user and admin experience, because at the end of the day, Office is a productivity tool. If you're not allowing your users to be productive, they're going to find a different way to be productive. So having the tools built in from there was something that we thought about very, very heavily. The second one is around compliance or around data governance, right? Having a compliance tool that doesn't have proper data governance regulations, having the ability to say, as content expires out of my system, whether that's Exchange, whether that's SharePoint, whether that's your instant messaging content, make sure it's not discoverable. Make sure it's not in the system, because it doesn't do you any good if you say, well, my business policy is to say, I only keep content around for 3 years. And you have a subpoena, and the subpoena says, well, I like content that's 4 years old, let's say. And if it's there, it doesn't matter what your business policy is. You still have to produce it in the court of law because it's there. So having these tools built in, having that single point of truth is something that we spent a lot of time looking at, and we spent a lot of time both from the data governance and the immutability standpoint talking to lawyers, regulatory bodies around the world to making sure that what we did was applicable to laws around the world. The third thing that we looked at from all these organizations from a compliance standpoint is immutability. Right? Immutability is this concept that if you say something is there, that it is non-tampered with, it hasn't been altered, it hasn't been modified, it is the original point of truth. One concept of immutability is if you think about when you have, I'm assuming everyone remembers burning DVDs or burning CDs, right? You know, that once you burn it to that CD, it's kind of written in stone. The problem with some of that is that as you write it to CDs, has anyone tried to read a CD from 10 years ago or something like that? It's hit or miss, right? Like sometimes it works, sometimes you get read errors because the media dies. So we actually looked at what are ways that we can guarantee immutability of data, that non-tamperability of data, from a software perspective, which is a different way of thinking about data when you want to maintain it in a non-tamperable state. You don't have to move it outside of your context. And so I'll talk to you a little bit about what we're doing from an in-place strategy, or what we call in-place holds, our in-place queries, things like that. And finally, this is actually a data point from IDC, which is an analyst company. They provide a lot of reports and data. You know, they looked at the data that mankind was creating, just in general. And in the year 2012, there was the equivalent of about 50 libraries of Congress. And Library of Congress in the US is basically every single publication, every single book that gets created during that year gets put in the Library of Congress. They have some discretion to say, I don't want this, this is junk or whatnot. But it's a lot of data. If you look at the amount of data that was created in 2013, it's not just the Library of Congress. It's all of the data in 2012 to the beginning of mankind. Right? We're just, the amount of data we're collecting year over year is just growing exponentially. And the reality of that in an enterprise and an organization, over 90% of that sits in Exchange, and the remainder sits in SharePoint or other document repositories. Having the ability to find that content as it exists across your organization in your Microsoft data stores is something that we set about doing with some of our tools around e-discovery. And I'll spend a lot of time talking to you about what we're doing from an e-discovery standpoint. Let's see if this works. So I'm going to try and touch on as much of this as I can. I'm going to give you some demos. When I think about the way we frame our compliance story, it really is around two distinct things. One is around containing and preserving all that content. And we have a number of different tools from a storage management perspective, whether that's the Archive or SkyDrive Pro, or from the data governance perspective where you're looking at our retention policies to expire content out, or even just preserving, which is around the hold capability. But for me, all of that sits in this large bucket of what are we doing to actually hold on to the data that you say that you want to keep. And then the second is when you actually have to sit through and examine that data. When you have to refine that content down so you're taking that large volume of data that is requested during a subpoena or through an information request and providing only accurate and relevant content so that you're not wasting amount of time. And we have a number of different tools there as well. I want to spend a tiny bit of time around what we've done from the user experience, because it is such a differentiator when you talk to your users as far as what they're doing. From us, we wanted to provide a very seamless experience when it comes to looking at content, when it comes to actually when it comes to making things transparent for users. So we have this concept of the in-place archive. So if your primary mailbox, which everyone I'm assuming is either used or has seen Exchange in some vernacular or in some capability, where you have your inbox, your sent items, your primary folders, however you organize your mailbox. And then we have a second parallel hierarchy, which is your archive mailbox. And that will follow the same way that you manage your primary mailbox and your archive mailbox. And so if you're a piler and you put things into just a few categories or you put things only into a few folders, those same folders will persist in the archive mailbox. Similarly, if you're a filer and you take your content, every single email, and you move it into different folders, calendar one, et cetera, you can keep that same hierarchy as it moves from the primary mailbox to the archive mailbox. And it's not just available from Outlook, it's also available from Outlook Web App. And so you'll see things like this where you're my pen's not very good, but the folders will exist in Outlook as well as Outlook Web App and on Outlook Mobile. So as you're using it on your phone with your iPhone or whatnot, you'll see that same behavior show up there as well. About 5 years ago, we purchased a company called Fast. Are any of you familiar with the Fast technologies that we purchased about 5 years ago? They did a lot of really interesting, really different ways of search. Right? They were a search technologies company. And we integrated part of their technology into SharePoint in previous iterations. And in Exchange 2013 and SharePoint 2013, as well as Link 2013, we've incorporated their capabilities into our engines. And so they are now Exchange's new indexing engine. They're SharePoint's indexing engine and search capabilities. With that, you get a lot of the rich benefits from the admin side when you're searching across large, large corpuses of data. But you're also going to see great improvements from the end user side, right? So you're going to get some of the benefits like hit highlighting, or the ability to search multiple repositories from an end user's perspective in a single go. So from one search, they can search the primary mailbox and the archive, as opposed to searching a primary mailbox through Outlook and your archive mailbox through some third-party tool that they have to download. Making that really fast, making that very, very simple. Our goal is across the board, and this isn't just from an end user perspective, this is for organizational search, and as I'll show you with e-discovery as well, is that we want to have 90% of searches complete within 1 second, 95% of searches complete within 5 seconds, and 99% of searches complete within 10 seconds. And if you're searching through terabytes of data, that's pretty revolutionary from a speed perspective on e-discovery and just to search as well. Moving forward here. Another thing from the end user side, and then we're going to slowly move our way into some more of the compliance, admin perspective of the compliance story is, we looked at ways on what were some of the challenges around compliance as it came to looking at multiple versions of collaboration. So right now, if you have vendors, third parties, or whatnot, and you want to think about, well, how do I communicate with them? Let's say it's a proposal and I send it to my boss and three other people. I'm usually going to email it to them and they're going to make their changes and send them back to me. And I'm worrying about, well, I have revision1_ak.1.final.final final final final. You know, just people using different vernaculars on how, different terms on how to keep it. And then it's my job to push all that content together and make sense of all of the different versions. But there's better ways, right? Everyone's at this point familiar with SharePoint and like the co-authoring capabilities, the ability to use versioning. And so we looked at what was available in Outlook. And Outlook is a place where a large percentage of organizations, their users in their organization spend a lot of their day. But from a document collaboration perspective, SharePoint was a great solution for that. And so we've actually merged those two capabilities together and introduced what's called site mailboxes. And over here you can see in the kind of like the back screenshot, and it's probably not visible from you back there, but what you'll see in Outlook is as you provision a site mailbox, either the end user can do it or the admin can do it, you'll get this document repository showing up for your end users. And in there is an inbox folder, there's documents folders, it's whatever folders that you want to create. But the inbox folders will have all the emails that are relevant to that collaboration experience. And the document folders will have all of the SharePoint documents that are stored in that location. And so from Outlook, you can drag and drop content. From SharePoint, you can drag and drop content. But to the end user, it looks like, hey, I'm in Outlook, I'm getting my work done. As I move to SharePoint, they're in SharePoint, and they can see those emails, and they're getting their work done. But the content is stored in where it's most relevant. You'll hear me say that a few times. Content is stored where it's most relevant. We want to have all that metadata that is stored in Exchange, so when you do that discovery request, you're finding that content. When you're storing that content from SharePoint, those documents, PDFs, whatever you want in SharePoint, you're keeping that same metadata there. So it's discoverable, and you're keeping that richness there as well. So with that, I'd like to just do a quick demonstration of data loss prevention. And I just want to show you what it is, and then I'm going to come back and talk to you about what some of the benefits are and actually some of the nitty-gritty, if you will. So we all have this problem. Is it showing up? Yeah. We all have this problem where, is there anyone in here from HR? Good, so I can pick on HR. HR likes to write a lot of documents, right? HR has this, they want to put a lot of policies out there. IT is responsible for a lot of policies as well. There's compliance policies from the legal group. For most of your organizations, for most of your users in your organization, I'd wage that you think you hire good individuals, trustworthy individuals for the most part. People don't go out of their way to break the law or to try and mess with the policies that have been set up. At the same time, how many people remember reading the entire, and is there anyone from Microsoft in the room here? Our Microsoft policy is 168 pages. Did you ever read it? Every single page and remember it all. Right? We all try and remember it. We read it when we can, but it's hard. People have other focuses, and as it changes, you know, we have these, in Microsoft, we have these at least yearly training. Hey, things have changed, making sure that you're up to the standards of business conduct and et cetera. But at the same time, you don't remember everything. You're making things, there's an opportunity for breaking some of those rules. And so you have an opportunity as an end user to accidentally leak data outside of your organization. And so we wanted to make that process of blocking that or making that at user education much stronger. So I have this new email here. This is from me. I'm outside of this organization. I'm logged in as it's cut off there, but I'm logged in as Belinda Newman. And I'm just asking for some information about this content at TechEd. Let's make sure this content looks good. I'm going to reply to this message. I'll pop it out so everyone can see. And it's saying, all right, so can you add some thoughts? Here. Let me just add them first. I'll just add all of these documents here. And at the top, you'll see two things full up. One is that the following recipient is outside your organization. That's my name. It's an external user. The second is that at the very top, you see policy tip pop up saying, hey, before you send this, you should know that this email contains sensitive information. Are you sure you want to do this? And if you hover over this policy tip, you'll see that this message may contain sensitive information. And what is that sensitive information? In this example, I'm just using a credit card number. It's easy to be applicable to everyone. And you know that, okay, I'm as an end user, I'm not supposed to send credit card numbers outside my organization. Makes sense to me. I may have not remembered that, or maybe I forgot for a second. And then we have this button to say learn more about, or this on a link to learn more about your organization's policy. And what we found in Microsoft is by having this link here, we're improving the understanding of our compliancy documents and policies significantly much more than previously, because people are understanding that they're actually taking action at the point of non-compliance. As you're about to make a mistake, you're much more likely to read why you almost made the mistake as opposed to going through that 168-page document and remembering every single thing. And so this Learn More link can go to anything in your organization. What you also see is it'll scan through everything in the body, everything in the subject, as well as all of the attachments it can find. And this is an actual real credit card number. It's the official number that Visa gives to demo credit cards. It passes what's called Lund's algorithm, and it has an expiry and information there. So it is actually looking through. It's not just looking through a 16-digit number. And I'll walk you through how that process actually works on the back end. So it's pretty cool. It's built in. There's a lot of different things you can do as far as rules. What happens if you only have one? What happens if you have a middle ground? What happens if you have an excessive number of breaches? And take different actions based on this. Another thing that we have that I'm not going to show you is it's patent pending, but it's in the product in Outlook 2013, which is to do an override. It's what we call the break glass scenario. Kind of going back to what I said earlier, that Outlook and Office is a productivity tool. We want to make sure people are able to get their work done. And so if you have to send, let's say you're purchasing you're an admin and you're purchasing hotel blocks for all of your employees, and you have everyone's credit card information. And it's a valid use of sending credit card information to an outside source. You'd get this policy tip pop up, but because it's a valid use, you would have an override button. And you can click the override button, and it'll kick off a policy and an audit trail, but you're able to get your work done. And all of these are configurable, whether you want them or whether you don't want them from the IT perspective. Sorry, who said that? It will scan credit cards, it'll scan whatever sort of policy template. If you have it configured, you can also have it configured to rights protect it or zip it or however you want to manage it. I think the default is send out as is. Or default if you allow it. Is that up there? All right. So this is a little bit of a high level. It can get very complicated. I've tried to bubble it up so it made a lot of sense logistically or logically. How the DLP system works is the admin works with the business group, works with compliance, and comes up with the appropriate policies. You go through and you go into the EAC and you set up the DLP policy configuration. I'll walk through the components of the policy configuration as well. That policy configuration then gets pushed down to everyone's Outlook 2013 client. And this happens on a daily basis by default, so that Outlook can then track and monitor what the policies are for your organization locally. So even if you're offline, you're able to access some of this content. As people start using it, you're going to get more and more policy education. That's where the Learn More link and some of the other behavior exists. And if something needs to be sent, it then goes in back to the Exchange server from Outlook, and the policy is evaluated a second time. This is done because people have other clients besides Outlook 2013, right? There's mobile clients, there's iPhones, there's POP clients, right? However you want to set it up, but we're making sure that just because you use a different client doesn't mean that you can break out of jail here. And if allowed, we're going to kick off an audit and incident report generation so that you're keeping these trails for future use. So walking you through what some of the templates are. So every template contains a number of different sensitive content types. And one of the sensitive content types could be a credit card number, it could be a bank number. The next slide, I'll actually show you some of the credit card numbers. But we have we have a number of different templates that are available out of the box. It's not just US. This is a little bit of an old screenshot, so you're not seeing all of them, but we have financial data, we have PCI DSS, we have a lot of different templates that are built out of the box. And you can obviously customize and add templates as you see fit. From a sensitive content detection perspective, we have about 50 data types with algorithms backed on them. I think it's 49 out of the box. Again, it's across the world. And I've forgotten if New Zealand has anything out of them specifically. Yeah. There is one. Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad you're in the front row. So there is one content type that is specific to New Zealand that's in here. But it's all XML on the back end. It's actually pretty trivial to, it's not simple, but it's pretty trivial to actually edit the content type to match, you know, your company's ID number or whatever identification string you have that is relevant for your organization. We actually have, I talked to an organization maybe 2 years ago, and it was an IT guy in this organization, and he got so pumped up about this, he actually quit his job the next day, and he started a company that just builds content type and templates for Microsoft, and a number of them are free. I'm not going to plug his, but I'm sure you can do a search for his just because it's recorded, just do a search for his website, and there's a number of different things that you can download as well. So every single one of these templates has to be put into a policy rule. And the policy rule has three separate actions, or three separate components. First is the predicate, or what we call the condition. This is what to happen if the condition is true, right? To say, is it a member of this group? Is it this person? Is it inside my organization? Is sending something outside the organization? Is it using, if it contains sensitive information, et cetera, et cetera. If that's true, you want to take some action upon this. And this is where you can either NDR it, you can rights protect it, as you were mentioning, you can moderate it, you can send it to someone else for further review before sending out of your organization. And then the third part is to actually take exception. For the corner offices, maybe they have different rules, or for someone else in your organization, maybe HR has a different policy set, and you want to have an exception based on that. It's very similar to transport rules. Has anyone set up transport rules in the past? It's built on that transport rule framework. It's actually using the transport rule code and just extended with the 2013 capabilities in. So it's essentially the V3 of our transport rules, but now we're including DLP. We wanted to include DLP in previous versions, but we never did. And then we finally said, all right, in 2013, there's enough of a compliance demand, so we're going to put it into 2013. I specifically want to call out the RMS template. Right? As you're looking at sensitive information, the action that most organizations want to take, or an often used action, is to encrypt that content. You know, allowing people to get their work done, but providing perhaps an RMS template for the recipient to read that content. This is an interesting slide. This is completely faked. I just drew some lines on here because it's the point I want to portray is that we have out of the box very, very solid DLP reporting, auditing capabilities, especially for our online product. But if I'm showing you a slide and everything is zero, it doesn't quite get the point across that it's an interesting slide, right? So. We'll basically say, what are all the policies, how many detections, how many overrides, you can pull it through. The other alternative is to show the Microsoft.com information, and that our lawyers really just don't like us to show that sort of stuff. But you'll have all this information for every single website or for every single email domain that you have in your organization. One thing that is very powerful is, so the DLP reports can be downloaded into an Excel workbook, and you can really do some magic with some of the power maps and power pivots, power views and power pivots in that capability. It's something that I used to do a lot with just looking at the data and understanding, are we setting up a policy that's different or something that we need to change? From a policy perspective, the default DLP policy types are always enabled as test only. So an organization can say, all right, let's see what happens when we roll out this policy type, and you can start getting the reports of saying, all right, we're getting a lot of people sending credit card information, or we're getting a lot of people sending out bankrupt numbers, or whatever sort of policy that you have set up. Understand your data model, understand how people are using your technology, before putting it in test or enforce mode so you can actually lock that down. It's kind of a little bit of a tricky thing to understand what your users are doing before you put in policy. And giving that sort of insight is something that we kind of learned the hard way in Microsoft. We put this down and suddenly all of our admins couldn't book hotel rooms for their GMs or whatnot, right? And so some of these painful learnings that we go through hopefully make their way to you as well. So let's look through what goes through from a content analysis perspective. There's five stages of a DLP rule. The first is to understand to actually get that content. So Outlook or Exchange will read that email and say, okay, looks like there's some interesting information in here. And they'll do a regex analysis on that, regex analysis, and say, all right, there's 16 or 15 digits, and I'll keep going with the credit card example, but it's relevant in whatever sort of content type you have. 16 digits or 15 digits could be a credit card number. Let's do some function analysis and understand what's there. And I have two examples on the left and right. And the first one, it'll go through the algorithm, and for a credit card number, as I mentioned, it's going to use Lund's algorithm, and it'll look through and say, all right, this number matches the checksum, and that 1234, 1234, 1234, 1234, just a bogus number, people are messing with something, that one doesn't match the checksum. But we also take it a step further. We want to make sure we're not causing a lot of false positives. And so we'll do a keyword, or what we call a corroborative evidence. I think in the slide I just have additional evidence because that fit a little cleaner. To make sure that, all right, just because it's a credit card number, what's some other evidence that you have for this to make sure that it really is a credit card number? And so we'll look for something like expires or EXP or like 0407 to make sure that it's something else that makes it a valid credit card number. At least in the US, you're not able to do anything with just the 16-digit number. You need at least, you know, that four-digit number or the three-digit number on the back of the credit card, or you know, some other bit of evidence, if you will, to make sure that it's a real thing. At that point, Outlook or Exchange will say yes or no, this is a valid credit card number or sensitive content type, and then take action upon this. And so in the top example, that's a valid credit card number. And in the bottom example, it's just a booking code, for instance. So what happens if you get an incident report, right? Or what does that look like in your organization? You'll see a number of different things in each incident report, and I want to walk through all of these. One is, what is the severity of this audit data? Is it high? You can set these based on the rules. Is it medium? Is it low? And you can take different actions based on that. Did the user override this? Was that glass ceiling concept applicable in this environment? Or did they just, or was it not something that you had set up? Or did they mark this as a false positive and say that, hey, someone needs to take action on this because the rules you are using aren't set up correctly? Maybe you have to take a second action there. You look at the data classification type. And this one was, I'm using the credit card number. There was one incident of this. The confidence that it was actually a credit card number is 85, which meets my minimum bar for the confidence number. And then you also look at the rule hit, the ID match, and some of that other information. These slides will be made available to you, but it's just know that each incident report has actionable content. And it's not something that we find, hopefully is not, people aren't sending out hundreds and thousands of bits of data, but it's something that we expect is important from an auditing and a reporting standpoint. Especially if you're in an industry that gets asked often, what does that look like for your, what is the data leakage or data loss prevention strategy for your organization? And I know that in New Zealand, it's particularly, is it the Prime Minister? Prime Minister was in the news? Or about, is it a Prime Minister? I'm forgetting the actual title. Yeah. On accidentally leaking information, and so there's interesting ways and things that we can do to make that experience better. And that just having that high-profile person in the news also kind of puts it in everyone's minds from what's available from a DLP perspective. One thing from an auditing perspective that is, or from a reporting perspective that we chose to actually not do firsthand is to include our reporting capabilities for on-premises. So for online, you saw the reports and the that were available, but for on-premises, we've actually partnered with Dell, who've extended their message stats business insights to allow for on-premises reporting of the DLP processes that are happening in your organization, And they'll plug directly into our DLP engine and pull out some of that data and give it to you in a similar fashion to what you would get in Exchange Online. I'm now going to jump into Link and talk a little bit about what's available from a Link storage archiving perspective. So in Exchange 2010 and Link 2010, you could get some Link messages into Exchange. All right, how many people are familiar with conversation history? That's impressive. That's very good. So conversation history was a way to say, all right, this content I'm going to keep in my Exchange, and it'll be indexed and searched from that. It has some down points, right? It didn't really stand up to my compliance test. Are there any easy ways for it to be not able to capture all the data? And in reality, it's actually the opposite is true. It's too easy to make it not capture the data. You needed to have Outlook 2013 or Outlook and Link open at the same time on the same desktop. Outlook from the client side would write to Link on the client side. Link on the client side would write to Outlook on the client side. Outlook would then upload that to the Exchange server, and then it would be stored in Exchange, and you could put on hold or whatnot. But if you're using Outlook web app, or if you're using Outlook on your phone, or if Outlook wasn't open, there were just a lot of scenarios that the client-side information just never made it to the right part, or if Outlook crashed, right? Like, there's just a number of different scenarios. So we in the 2013, as well as the online suite of products, we took a back-end approach. We're saying that if a user is on hold, and I'll walk you through the hold example in a few slides. If a user is on hold, we're going to actually do it server-side. We're going to sync the states and have that content in Link for instant messages, for meetings, all that content be stored in Exchange. And before I show you how it works, I want to actually walk through some of the scenarios, if you will. So the second point is that it's not related to the Exchange archiving feature. And I specifically put this in because compliance to Microsoft is irrespective of the in-place archive. Right? Those are two separate terminologies. Compliance can be done with the in-place archive, or it can be done without the in-place archive. You'll have the exact same story. And so whether or not you have the in-place archive set up, you can still have Link archiving write to Exchange, and it'll write in a compliant manner. To do this, you are going to need LYSS, or LIS, depending on which part of the world you use the terminology for, and the brand new UDC. And so it'll use those components to tie them together. To actually set it up, it's not a terrible number of steps, but you do have to think about, well, do I want to enable this at the global level, site level, or the service level from a Link perspective? And when you decide what to do there, you just use the PowerShell commandlet, set CS archiving configuration, dash enable archiving something, enable Exchange archiving, true. And when you do that, Link says, all right, we're ready to go. We can set this up. At the second layer, you need to choose which of your users or all of your users you want to enable that with that policy. And that's where you use the set CS user to initialize that off. So when you do this, you're going to be able to, once you have that set up, you're going to be able to set query-based holds, full in-place holds on your users as you would from the Exchange content. All of that data will be discoverable and relatable in the Exchange context. And it'll stay in place as long as you want. So if you have everything in your organization or for your user kept on hold for a rolling period of time, what we call a time-based in-place hold for, let's say, 2 years. As that 2-year window moves along, that link content will, as long as it's in that window, will be preserved in an immutable state there as well. A few gotchas. To do this from a discovery perspective, you need to make sure that you include that compliance officer or the person that's going to be doing the discovery into the appropriate role group. By default, no one has the ability to do discovery management. Kind of makes sense. You don't want to give anyone in your organization the ability to search anyone's mailbox by default. So right now, by default, it's empty. you have to specifically choose the users or the groups to be a part of that role group. You'll also need to give the appropriate information to the users to access the Discovery search mailboxes if you're going to be doing these searches in EAC versus the eDiscovery Center. And those commands are there as well. So where do we actually keep this data? You know, we're not storing in, because this is used from a compliance perspective, we're not going to store it in that conversation history folder. We're storing it in the purges folder, which is in the non-IPM subtree of the Exchange mailbox. And has anyone ever used this tool? It's called EWS Editor. Let me see if I can just zoom in a little bit. So if you navigate, it's similar to EWS Editor. And so you can see in the folder root, in the recoverable items, in the purges folder, you can see all these conferences and conversations that are stored as an ipm.note.microsoft.conversation, whatever the relative thing is in there. This means it's discoverable, but it means that it isn't accessible from the end user perspective. And so from an end user, if you want to allow the user to view some of their old conversations or some of that older content, you still probably want to think about the conversation history folder sync because this is a compliance scenario. A couple more gotchas. This is one that I learned with two lawyers breathing down my neck. From audio conferences, there is a 20-minute delay. So as an audio conference finishes, you'll have to wait 20 minutes before that content is written to Exchange. You can kickstart it if that's something that is very important to you with the invoke CES storage service flush command. And then if you have a non-default meeting, you need to think about that slightly differently because as you're doing your queries, they'll show up a little bit differently. So that was link stored in Exchange, which then gets me to the next part about, well, now how do I find some of this content in my organization? There is a framework put together by the EDRM Council. It's the Electronic Discovery Reference Model Council. Microsoft's a part of that. A lot of third-party archiving and compliance veterans are a part of that, where we looked at the data stream of how people are using compliance to meet some of their e-discovery needs and put together a framework. And if you go to edrm.net, you'll see this very large, it's almost printable poster that you can put up on your wall and say, look, here we are in the production phase, or here we are in the review, or here are these other phases. When I talk to people about this, this is really about breaking it into four distinct aspects of working. One is take all that content that you have in your organization, identify what's relevant and preserve it. Put it on lockdown. The second is, now that you have that, is to search across that and process it further so that it's like a reverse, or it's a funnel, right? You're moving it down, you're bringing less and less content. The third is actually go through and review what's in there, sometimes from a manual perspective, looking at it individually. And then finally, you produce it. And this production could be to a third-party council, could be to another tool, it could be to paper, right? There's other ways of producing it. Every single industry has their own way that they like to think about that production of data. And so we're looking at that. And to me, this actually boils into two similar things. One is you have this volume of data. And I'll give a Microsoft example. The average Microsoft request for information, I won't call it a subpoena because sometimes it's internal, has about 13 million pages. A page is a term that lawyers still think in, right? They print things and they like to have a page. So even though it's email, even though it's content, they'll think in terms of pages. 13 million pages. In the US, a lawyer average, at least in the West Coast, it's about $1,000 an hour. $1,000 an hour turning through 13 million pages would make them very rich, right? Like that's a lot of money. So it was our goal to bring that down to more manageable time frame. As we get to that production phase, the average Microsoft produced data is about 243 pages. It's still a lot of data, but it allows you to make sure that you have the relevant information. So you're decreasing the volume and increasing that relevance. And there's a lot of stages that go through there, but we wanted to make sure that it was built directly into the product perspective. Previous to Exchange 2013, SharePoint 2013, Link 2013, all of our online tool sets, a request for data in Microsoft took in the order of 4 weeks. Find the data, come back, and go through and understand what it is. In Microsoft, we're now turning it into a 4 to 6 hour process. So really turning the wheels on what's available. And I'll walk you through another example of what's there as well. I'm going to actually do that in demo. It's obviously more fun in demo. So I'm logged into the eDiscovery Center, and this is a place that the lawyers will spend a lot of their time, compliance officers, depending on how an organization's set up. And for each case, they would create a case for in the tool set. And so this is the Northwind Traders case. And here there is where they would spend a ton of time identifying the relevant information and holding it, and then further doing that search and export as a second stage. And let me walk you through a little bit of the example. So, has anyone done a discovery request or been involved in a discovery request? I see a few hands. Is it fun? No. the way it works is, and it really isn't fun. And I've been on that end as well. The way it works historically is you have a team of lawyers on the defendant side and a team of lawyers on the litigation side. Those team of lawyers will say, all right, we have something that's very interesting we need to go through and understand. And so they'll go and they'll sit in a conference room, three on each side, and say, all right, well, let's identify the defendants that what we call custodians, that are custodians of this data. And here they would say, in this example I have, Garth Ford is really interesting. He's been doing some questionable behavior. Katie Jordan's been involved somehow. They'll narrow their window down. Perhaps they know some SharePoint locations. Perhaps they know some other data repositories that have this information. And they'll leave that six-person meeting, and then they'll come back to IT and say, all right, I have this request. Give me some data. At which point IT said, we can't just do that. It's not just magic. We have to go through and go through our production capabilities. IT will come back and say, all right, here's the data you requested. And the lawyers will look at it and say, all right, well, that was too much, way too much. I can't manage that. Or they'll say, actually, that was too little. We didn't find what we were looking for. And then they'll have that second meeting. And that second meeting, they'll go through and say, all right, it was too much. Let's change our criteria a little bit. Come back to IT, and IT will say, all right, here's the data you requested. And then let's say it's perfect there. And that process at $1,000 an hour can be very expensive, and it can take a lot of time. And so what we do now is we're giving these compliance officers the ability to walk into those meetings directly and say, all right, well, you said Katie Jordan and Garth Fort, and let's pick another individual here. I think I clicked it. I'll pick on Dennis here. Is there anyone named Dennis? All right, pick on Dennis. And then perhaps add some SharePoint locations. This is if you know the URL. If you're on premises, you can have a file server location, like location one, Northwind. This is an online tenant, so I don't have one. Hit OK. And because the content is in place, you haven't moved it to a third-party repository, you're able to query this data nearly instantly and understand what's going on. In this first searching window, it's actually validating that these users are still active, you have the right appropriate permissions. I don't know why we called it searching, because it's not really doing the searching until that window goes away. And so these people in that pre-review meeting can say, all right, here are the, three custodians, and two document sources, and there are 34 items and 31 megs of relevant information. Does this look appropriate? Does this look not appropriate? They can fine-tune their queries further. They can even say, actually, we're only looking for the last 6 months, or the appropriate author senders. I'll remove some of these, let's say. They can get some of the statistics on this content and understand what that scope of information is before they have to actually preserve it. So once it looks good, it's actually pretty easy. You can just choose to enable the in-place hold, and now you've locked that down. And anytime something meets this criteria, so in this case, anything in from one of these sources, from one of these custodians or one of these data sources, in the future, it's going to be added to the repository that is held. So you don't have to keep running these queries every single hour or every single day. You know, I'll show this on the next phase, but you can also preview these results, right? So you can actually look at that data live and say, sure, it's 288, but I want to know what those 288 are. Yes, 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 yes. No, no, yeah, okay, looks okay, and understand what it is. You hit save. And that first window, I'll just switch back over. That identification and preservation, it's done. It's very, very clean. It's a simple way to actually understand what is in your organization that you want to preserve. A couple caveats, right? So from an Exchange perspective, if you're running this, if you're running SharePoint eDiscovery Center on-premises, we will be able to query on-premises and online. SharePoint can only stay within the realm that it's in. So if you have a hybrid organization where you have some SharePoint on-prem and some SharePoint online, you would need to do this query in both locations. But for Exchange, it can traverse. So that was the identify and hold. The second thing that an organization will need to do is say, all right, sometimes it goes to court, sometimes it doesn't go to court, sometimes it's a scenario where they, where the lawyers will make a deal, right? Well, they'll broker a deal and say, actually, we found a lot of information. We found 288. We're going to pay out some money because it's easier than going through the process. But sometimes you actually have to sit down and actually dive deeper. Or if it's an audit, you might have to really sit down and understand what's in that data. And so we built this search and review capability directly into the eDiscovery Center, where you have the ability to just quickly create a number of different queries as you need, and find this like this, you know, find this through this toolset. The thing we learned from moving from Exchange 2010's multi-mailbox search to this, you know, broad capability is that the language lawyers and compliance people use is different than the language we use to search the web, right? When we go to Google or Bing, we're searching for bear shark or something else like that, and you're finding that one example. But when I sat with these lawyers have these Excel spreadsheets with 300 item terms that they're copying and pasting, because they're just massive amounts of queries with nots and, you know, not attorney-client privileged and not relevant to this case, just huge, huge query strings that you would never search in Bing, right? It doesn't make sense. And the vernacular that they're using is different, right? They're using proximity searches. They're using Boolean searches. And so for the 2013 and online suite, we've introduced what's called KQL, which is keyword query language, which allows us to do things like, so over here I have Northwind near 30. And the near 30 is what we call a proximity search. So anything, this query is going to find Northwind within 30 words of the word contoso, or within 30 words of any word starting with trade, or T-R-A-D, trad, right? And so being able to cast the appropriately sized net that makes sense for your organization is important. And some of these are features that you just, you know, when I talk to lawyers, they're like, oh, finally, you're speaking to me in a language I understand, right? It's different. Another thing that's interesting from a query statistics perspective is if you have 300-word query, let's take that example, and you accidentally say and instead of or, your result set will be very different, right? You're going to find way too much information or way too little information for what you're looking for. And so we'll actually break down every single aspect of this query and do individual queries on this. So you can see 71, 42, 66, 80, 42 million. That 42 million might be something you need to work on a little bit. Also a very important thing for lawyers to understand how to fine-tune the queries to find what they're looking for. And then from a legislation perspective, this is the wrong button. I thought it was that one. Oh, there it is. Judges will often ask, you'll have to pardon me. I know this is valid in Australia, but I haven't been able to locate whether judges in New Zealand are asking for this content. But there's often a request that judge will say, prove to me that you are following my rules and finding the right data that I've asked you to find. And we have an organization that will take this just straight print of this page and say, look, you asked for Katie, Garth, and Dennis. Here are the queries we've presented to them, to those infrastructures. Here's from the SharePoint side, here's the exact queries we've done from the SharePoint side, and you can understand what's there. And in a very long, complicated query, you can see exactly what's being found and what's happened there. And this is proof to a judge that you're doing your due diligence as applicable to the law. All right, as we move down, you can find that from an exchange perspective, you're going to be able to see the exact, let's pick contract signing, and it'll open up the link directly in a slightly modified version of Outlook Web App where you can't edit anything, right? So the reply, forward, flag, all these behaviors are blocked from the user, but the admin, looks like I picked one. All those behaviors are there, so the admin or the compliance person can look at actually the real content. They have the filters available to them. I don't actually know if there's any link content in here, but if there is, you can see the instant messaging and the content that I was referring to earlier. There isn't. I'll click on one on the SharePoint tab as well. So the Exchange tab will have Exchange and link content. The SharePoint tab will have SharePoint and file server content, and it'll be composed there as well. So here, if you have a document, a PDF, a zip file, whatever, you'll see the raw thing there. Or you can open them up. So you can open them up as a full presentation here. I can hit OK or cancel. I don't trust the network, so I'm not going to. Let me see if I can pick another one as well. It'll be a copy of it. Yeah. You can edit it, but you won't be able to save it back to that repository. And then each of the links will be the will show a fully rendered page. So it's actually using the actual content here. And it'll show the appropriate one that lines up in the e-discovery search. And so that compliance officer can actually dig into this and say, oh, actually, maybe this recreational activity is where I need to go through and modify their query appropriately as well. It's one of the real benefits of having that in-place strategy. So the final thing that organization will want to do is that, and I'll switch back over. So we've now moved from search and process, a little bit of the review, is to actually produce that information. And in order to produce it, you have to put it into a format that is, as I mentioned earlier, relevant for that industry. And so we've built direct capabilities to allow exporting of this content from the eDiscovery Center. And we've actually implemented an industry standard. It's called EDRM-based XML. And this XML format has all of the capabilities to be imported in third-party tools, and it's reviewable by different products. I believe that is my time, so I'll move fast. We have a number of different features to remove duplicate exchange content so that at $1,000 an hour, you're only giving the lawyers the relevant information that they want. And similarly, from a SharePoint perspective, including appropriate versions. So you're not keeping 42 versions of that content. They're just looking at the one that was relevant for the case. And you can download just the report or the results. And if you download the results, it'll be a client-side download from the service or from your servers. And you'll get this quick one-time run. And it'll pull that content down in EDRM base XML. And you'll have appropriate PSTs. You'll have appropriate MHT files, which are MIME HTML files, which are zip files, essentially, of a web page. And I won't log in right now, just from a time perspective. And any error files, as well as a metadata to XML file, which will give you all the appropriate linkages of where everything was, what the timestamps are, and what the GUIDs of everything are. So very, very powerful thing. It's built directly into Exchange, SharePoint, and Link, and it's available on our product sets. So with that, I think that is my last slide. I'm on the Twitterverse, something like that. So feel free to ask questions there. My email is ankurko at Microsoft. So feel free to email there. Yes?
When do you get access to the auditors in the user's mailbox? Does that mean they will be able to open the user's mailbox after that?
So the e-discovery permissions doesn't give them full mailbox permissions. It's a different permission set. So you can't do a authenticated open of that content, but you can review the email messages. It would give the same access to the primary mailbox and the archive mailbox. So for instance, they can't use Outlook and open that user's mailbox. They cannot. They have to use the appropriate tool sets to do. Now, if you give them those right permissions, then they could, sure. Yes? Is the IPM is a specific IPM, the file type. It's like a link file type. So it's ipm.note.microsoft. And I forget the. Yeah, correct. You would see the text of that. No, it is. It'll be the text of that discussion. Yeah. Yeah, over here. That's correct, yes. So you can use tiered storage. You can store it on cheaper disk. You can even store it in the cloud. You can have your primary mailbox on premises and then use the what we call Exchange Online Archiving and store it in the cloud. It's discoverable in the same way. Correct, yes.
Is the mailbox, the single item retention enabled through, which seems to still be in 2013,
so the question was, does the single item recovery, which is default 14 days, is that a deprecated feature? And actually, the way we thought about it is that the single item recovery should be used more as an end user self-service recovery capability. It'll still hold the content in a non-destructible fashion, but the query-based in-place hold is something that you can do in addition to get more of the administrative control. So you can use one instead of the other, but my recommendation is to keep one for just end user self-service as if they accidentally delete an item or even delete it from their deleted items, and keep the other for more of a compliance standpoint. Make sense?
Yep.
Yep. I think over here, yeah.
Sorry, public folders can be archived.
Not yet. No.
Is it coming?
We're working on it, yes. We're thinking about it. How's that? Yes. So redaction is something that, in a lot of scenarios, will happen through more of a manual process. And so we looked at using redaction in a tool like this, but we actually don't have redaction. So we'll look through a presentation tool or production tool to do some of that redaction capability. It's a good question, though. Yeah. It's one of the lucky, and the question was like, what essentially will Microsoft's technologies change as compliance standards evolve, right? One of the lucky things about being Microsoft is that some of these big bodies will actually come to us before anyone else and say, we're thinking about doing this. Does this make sense with Windows? Does this make sense as a technology implementation? And some of them will come to us not even knowing that we have capabilities in-house, and some of them will do it knowing that we have capabilities in-house. So the easy answer is yes, we hope so. And it kind of depends on the scale of the change as far as the impact of what we want to do. Right here on the end. Mm-mm. No, it is primarily from an Exchange perspective. Exchange will do the dedupe, and then SharePoint will do his own versioning control as well. Yeah. I'm sorry, I missed the question. The question was, do we have an import mechanism from third-party archives? We have a tool that's called PST Capture. So third-party archives, there's essentially three ways of getting third-party archived content into Exchange. And I'll stick with the Exchange side of the story because that's usually the most painful. The first is you take that content and you restore it back to the primary mailbox, and then you move it to Exchange, and then you set up the right policies to move the data around as you see fit. The second is to take that archived content, export it to PST, and then from the PST, we have a new mailbox import request, and then we have PST capture that can take those to that data source and put it into Exchange. And then the third is we have a number of third-party tools that can kind of go from one to the other. Forgetting the TransVault is one of them. Binary Tree does some stuff as well that can move the content from one source to another source or back. And I think there was an. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, so does the SharePoint policy
need permissions? You would need the same discovery management permissions to view that. Part of the. Yeah. Well, you can also scope it, right? And you can say that discovery management only for this OU or for these users. It is a little bit of the keys to the kingdom. You are allowing them to at least view, maybe not edit, but view a lot of data in your organization. And so it is a sensitive permission to think about.
Can
I use custom? You can filter on custom attributes. You can filter on custom. Yes, basically. There may be some limitations, but for the most part, there you can filter on custom queries. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the question was, can you classify the content? A little bit. It depends on how you deem the classification. So from a review perspective, it could work or it could work couldn't work depending on how you think about it. I know I'm well over. I'm happy to answer as many questions you have, but I'm in between you and alcohol, I know, so feel free to. Yeah.